Hearing. Wisconsin Supreme Court is now in session. The Honorable Chief Justice Annette Kingsland Ziegler presiding. Your silence is commanded.
All right, please be seated. Good morning. We are here for oral argument this morning, but we also are here to acknowledge that it is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley's final oral argument day after many, many, many years of public service. Her husband, Mark, is here, and her sister, Kathy, is here. If you could stand up so we could say hello to you. Anne is retiring from the bench in July. Justice Anne Walsh Bradley has been a dedicated public servant for how many years?
30.
30 years.
But who's counting?
And she's been a colleague of mine since I joined the court in 2007. She was a high school teacher before she entered law school. She earned her law degree from UW Law School in 1976. After a few years in private practice and also as a city attorney, she began working as a public defender. She was appointed to the State Public Defender Board in 1983. Her judicial career began in 1985 when she was appointed to serve as a circuit court judge in Marathon County, a position she held for 10 years. She was first elected to the Wisconsin Supreme Court in 1995, was reelected in 2005 and also 2015. She was the first woman elected, not appointed, elected to serve on Wisconsin's highest court.
Wow.
In addition to her judicial duties as justice, she currently serves as the chair of the Board of Trustees of the International Association of Women Judges, which has over 6,500 members in 143 countries. She's traveled worldwide promoting the association's programs. In her nearly 30 years on the Supreme Court, and having heard probably over 2,400 cases, maybe, in oral argument by this time, she may not have actually heard all of them. Get off of them, but it's still whatever the number is, I can assure you it's quite impressive. I don't know how many opinions that you've written, Justice Anne Walsh Bradley, but that number is also certainly impressive. And so I would like to thank you, Anne, Justice Anne Walsh Bradley, for your service to the public and your service on this court. Thank you.
Thanks.
It says sit, we sit, so.
Thank you for those kind words. It has been an honor for me to serve here for 30 years, to be part of this august group. And of course, I wouldn't be able to have done it without the unwavering support of my husband, right?
That's right.
The native language means far away place. And I still live in Wausau, and at times, although we have a place here, it's been a lot of commuting for 30 years. And then, of course, I couldn't have done it without a supportive family, in addition to a supportive husband. And my sister Kathy is here today as, I guess, the ambassador of the family. So thank you, both of you, for being here. And thank you to my wonderful colleagues, right? People ask me, will you miss this place and miss this job? And of course I will. And what makes this job is not only the heavy responsibility and an opportunity to serve, but an opportunity to serve with people who care deeply about the rule of law and care deeply about the people of this state. And although at times when you read our opinions, and dare I say even our separate opinions, right? Know that we are unified in our dedication to our mission, our calling, if you will, to be justices of the Wisconsin Supreme Court. So thank you for this opportunity. Thank you, Annette.
Thank you.
All right, well, we actually do have some work to do here today. So we'll move on to that. Calling 24 AP 1713, Wisconsin State Legislature versus Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction. If I could start with your appearances, please. Good morning. All right, good morning. So the argument times go as follows: 25 minutes followed by 30 minutes and 5 minutes on rebuttal. That's your understanding? With that, let's proceed.
Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court. Today's issues reflect an interlocking strategy to control how the executive branch spends funds and to limit the governor's partial veto power. It involves dissecting appropriations into multiple bills and crediting funds set aside for executive agency programs to JCF to control their destination and use. Those efforts are illegal and they misread the governor's veto authority. We're going to cover three topics: JCF's emergency fund, whether the Senate bill was an appropriation bill, and whether the governor's vetoes complied with Article 5. Let's look at JCF's piece of the puzzle first. The 2023 budget set aside $50 million for DPI for a literacy program. Apart from the specific budget motion and the other legislative documents we've provided, we know that because the legislature told us. Its complaint in the case described the funds as earmarked for the literacy program, and it filed affidavits from the co-chairs of JCF attesting that the $50 million was set aside for exactly that purpose.
Can I ask you about that before you go on, Counselor?
Sure.
So $50 million, when you say it's earmarked, so I'm looking at what this earmark is. It's an omnibus motion?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and it's voted on by exactly 16 people?
Correct.
Or 15 people? I can't count. So it's not part of the bill, right?
No, it's not explicitly part of the bill.
Would you agree that it's therefore not law?
So the appropriation itself that went into 28654 is law. And what we're using the omnibus motion for here is to resolve any ambiguity about where that money needs to go.
Okay, but for example, there's a lot of, this is a big motion. It's, got a lot of different earmarks. Is there any enforcement mechanism? Like, let's say that this earmark for, I don't know, I could pick one out of here, high cost special education. I mean, there's a ton of earmarks in here. If the JCF didn't give the money, is there any mechanism for, you could obviously sue, but it's not, again, I go back to my question I asked you, it's not part of the law, right?
It's true that there's no judicial mechanism to enforce whether, so the amount in the appropriation exactly matches the amount in the omnibus motion, as well as corresponds with budget motion 103, which was about DPI specifically. But Your Honor's absolutely correct. There's no judicial remedy where, say, a school district could come in and say, hey, we're not being reimbursed for this curriculum.
Even though you earmarked it for us. If JCF decided to give it to someone else, there's nothing they can do.
That's correct.
Or if they decided to do nothing, that's why we're here, kind of.
Right, exactly, Your Honor.
I mean, in a sense, I'm not to be too cute about this, but that is the answer, I think, to Justice Dowd's question. The judicial remedy is the one you sought, and it brought you here today.
Correct. We're here to fix the problem.
Okay.
And Your Honors are identifying the exact problem, which is instead of crediting those funds to a DPI appropriation directly, the legislature credited them to a JCF emergency appropriation, along with hundreds of millions of other dollars of funds set aside for specific agencies.
Counsel, if there is no legal requirement that that JFC actually use this money or release this money or even use it for the purposes it was earmarked for, do you have a remedy?
I think we do, Your Honor, because I think the intention of the law was to give it to those specific agencies for those specific purposes. And we think to correct the constitutional violation here, this agency can order those funds to be released. We think that's also confirmed by 13101 sub 7, which has existed alongside 13101 sub 3 since 1953. They've always been right there together, and says that if a provision relating to release is invalid, the court should consider the appropriation to have been made.
But you're arguing you would have some sort of legal entitlement to them. Do you argue you have a legal entitlement to money, or just as a matter of sort of equitable principles, we should just order the committee to give the funds to DPI?
It's essentially a savings construction, that the only way that this appropriation is legal is if it is, and we're only looking for the DPI money today, but the only way the appropriation was legal is that if it's released to DPI for the purposes for which it was set aside.
One question I have is, I think you're, calling this this challenge as applied challenge. I guess my question to you is, wouldn't your arguments apply to any use of the fund for earmarked spending? Why or why not?
We're not seeking relief on behalf of any other agency. Your Honor is correct that the arguments do apply to those other set-aside purposes.
Isn't this really then a facial challenge? I think that's how the circuit court saw this, and others argue that what you're advancing is really a facial challenge here rather than an as applied.
Well, because the relief we're seeking is limited to DPI, we don't see it as a facial challenge. That said, we don't concede that the emergency use of it would be constitutional. It's just that involves some other legal issues that we're not tackling today. We're just looking at the DPI piece of it. So if we turn to the statutes themselves, and I think the court understands these principles really well, so I'll do it briefly, and we've got a lot to cover this morning, obviously. Neither of the statutes under which JCF purports to act even purport to give it this authority. And you saw the Ledge Council memo saying this was not originally intended for the use it's being put to today. So you've got 28654, which is for an unforeseen emergency or situations where the agency's funds have proved to be insufficient. And then you've got 13101.3, which requires JCF to find that an emergency exists. And neither of those contemplates a situation where the money was anticipated to be needed at the time of the budget. And we think that,
doesn't the 13101 have an or after the emergency? So it isn't just an emergency. I don't have it in front of me at the moment, but it's emergency or some kind of supplement, isn't it?
Or insufficient to accomplish.
Any use that the JCF makes of it requires it to find that an emergency exists. If you go to, so we're under 3A sub 1, mm-hmm. And then that's not disjunctive, those are conjunctive. So an emergency exists and no funds are available and the purpose for which they're using has been authorized. So they need to find an emergency either way. And we think that square peg and round hole problem just shows us that this is an unconstitutional use of these monies. Because an appropriation is money that's set aside for a specified object and authorizes the executive branch to spend it for that purpose. But if JCF has the power the legislature claims, the money is credited to 8654, other than the $250 in JCF expenses that's in there somewhere, it has no set object. We know it's for the executive branch somehow, but it's GCF is deciding what it wants to do and how it wants to do it. And we know that a legislative committee can't appropriate funds. Article 8, Section 2 requires that an appropriation be made by law, and a law requires bicameralism and presentment, both houses voting and then presenting it to the governor for his review. Appropriation can't be delegated.
Finish your sentence, I'm sorry.
To a committee. Go ahead, Your Honor.
Sorry. I want to go back to how you're looking at 13-101-3A and go back to Justice Ann Walsh Bradley's question. Just giving you, you're there, okay. Mm-hmm. So I think this, I'm not sure I'm reading the statute the same way you are. So 3A, before you get to the sub one, yes?
Correct.
It does say unforeseen emergencies or insufficient to accomplish the purpose for which made. And I understand, and then it says if the committee finds, and then it says again, an emergency exists. So your argument, how do you read the or that is in sub A before you get to the sub one? I don't understand how you're doing that.
Right. I think that the insufficient to accomplish the purposes has to be read harmoniously, both with the language back in 28654, which talks about things that have proved to be insufficient. So that proved shows that over time we've realized that amounts that were sufficient at the time of the budget have proved not to be, first of all.
But second of all, can I just stop you? Because there's a phrase after that. I mean, in 28654A, it says fund which proved insufficient because of an unforeseen emergency. I don't understand the emergency language. I don't understand how you're getting around it, because this isn't emergent. There's not an emergency here, but the emergency language shows up twice in 13101, and the one time I just read it in
20.865. So I want to make sure I understand your question, Your Honor. Is your question, why does it use the adjective unforeseen in the spending authority and the appropriation, but not in 13101?
I'm not asking this very well.
Oh,
how do you not have to have an emergency?
How do we not have an emergency?
How do you not have to have one in order?
You have to have an emergency.
You do.
There has to be an emergency for this statute to even apply.
Okay. Great.
carry on.
That's the way I felt. Oh, great. So what do you do? I mean, is this surplusage or, and I'm looking at 3A13101, or insufficient to accomplish the purpose for which is made, which of course kind of parallels sub 4 of 20.865. So, I mean, why even have the or there if you just need an emergency?
Right, we think that corresponds with the language in 28654, where it says unforeseen emergencies or which prove insufficient.
But then what is the unforeseen emergency is of course the follow-up question.
Right, so either way, we're talking about a situation that the legislature and the agency could not have contemplated at the time of the budget. So an emergency definitionally is something that we're not planning for. When we set up the budget and come up with our awesome plans for how we want to run the government for the next 2 years.
But they knew enough to know that they needed money for literacy programs. I mean, none of us can see into the future to know exactly what we are going to need. But I see an unforeseen emergency as something like, I don't know, the COVID pandemic?
Correct.
A natural disaster?
So exactly, a national disaster, a pandemic, war, some completely unexpected.
Stop lifting. It's getting depressing.
You know, and I think the idea was when this emergency board, which remember originally was an executive branch board, mm-hmm. had this little bit of money to spend on unforeseen emergencies, it was for exactly those purposes. It certainly was not a holding pen for lots of money that the legislature wanted to give JCF power over. So that's what the statute actually is for. But the way that JCF is using it is to say, actually, we can spend it on whatever purpose, as long as there's a statutory purpose out there,
for whatever purpose and for whatever agency we want, or as Justice Kurofsky noted, none at all. That's not what the statute says, and that's not what the Constitution allows, because what JCF is doing in that situation is they're appropriating the monies instead of the full legislature.
But we don't know right now what they're going to do with that money. You want that money, and you've said you want that money based on the earmark. But the reality is the money's sitting in a fund right now, and it hasn't done anything with it. And for all we know, they are going to use it for an emergency and not give it to anybody for anything else, right? Like, that just hasn't happened yet.
Well, DPI has asked for the money, and they haven't been given it.
Right, but I'm saying JCF hasn't appropriated it anywhere. You're not here about something JCF did when saying that that's unconstitutional because JCF can only use it for emergencies, which is the argument you're making right now. That's not the case that we have in front of us.
Well, we know that they are saying that they don't have to give it to DPI. So I don't think, to the extent you're arguing ripeness, maybe?
Well, they're saying, well, maybe I am, because they're saying it, but nothing's...
So they're saying it, so we know that DPI asked for the money and has not been given the money.
And is DPI having an emergency that you think that if this is emergency money that you should get the money?
No, because we think it's unconstitutional for them to not, DPI not to get the money. That the idea that JCF maintains control about whether DPI gets it or not, or whether they give it to somebody else, that's unconstitutional.
Right, but it was put in an emergency fund, and that's where it is now, and you're saying you should get it from the emergency fund?
Yes.
Okay.
But there, just to follow up on that, again, going back to my earlier question, I don't understand the legal basis for that. So even if you were right that the statutory structure here is constitutionally problematic, I still don't see how you win and get the money, because that is not what the law says. There's no provision of law that actually gives the money to DPI or appropriates the money to DPI, which makes us different than, you know, other cases. Your argument was it was a saving construction, but there is no way to construe the statute to actually appropriate money to DPI. So I don't understand how you win, or even whether we even need to get to that question, because you don't get what you want either way. At least you have, I don't know what the legal basis for that remedy would be.
Okay. So first of all, I want to talk about when. Our first goal is to ask, we're asking this court for a declaration that JCF can't, that the legislature can't put money in this emergency fund from these omnibus motions where the amounts are set aside for specific agencies and specific purposes. That's the first win we're asking for. But then on Your Honor's question about how do we know what the right remedy is for savings construction, we know that 8654, we know that the intent was to give it to executive branch agencies. So then we have an ambiguity about who gets it and why. And we have all these clues about that answer that ambiguity. We have the-
Just back up for a minute though. An earmark does not create an ambiguity for purposes of a saving construction in a statute. You're saying a saving construction of the statute, or that there's some way to read the statute, or there's some ambiguity in the statute because of an earmark. That may be what the legislature was originally conceiving with the funds, but there's nothing in the statute that says anything about that. So I don't know how you get to an ambiguity in reading the statute, like in order to get the money.
Right. So the statute says give it to agencies, but we don't know which agencies. And in this particular case, we have not only the specific budget motion about DPI 103, we have all the LFB materials that were available to the legislature, both when it voted and after the act passed, but we have the legislature's concessions in this case. So in the complaint, when they sued my clients, they said that it was earmarked for DPI for the literacy program. And then we have affidavits from the JCF co-chairs who said this money was set aside for this purpose.
Right. I think what we're struggling with here is that we understand that there are hints and clues, but earmarks so different from an appropriation. And the way I'm looking at it, it could probably be parked in that fund indefinitely. And that's where I'm struggling with what's the legal nexus.
Right. So what we're asking the court to do is to construe its inherent authority and 13101 sub 7 as allowing it to release that money to DPI in a situation where no one is disputing that that's what this particular $50 million was for, not looking at any of the other money that was parked in that appropriation.
So we have Act 19, right? There's three separate acts we're dealing with.
Correct.
19 appropriated over $250 million to JCF for its supplemental account, and that's the 26854A account, right?
Correct.
And your argument is that 50 million of that belongs to you.
Well, it's a DPI.
Well, DPI.
So, only.
And you're doing that through programs that were created in Act 20. Act 20 created various programs, but it didn't fund any of them, right? Are we
Correct.
In agreement on that?
There was no funding mechanism in Act 20.
Literacy programs created under Act 20, zero funding for it. Money is sitting in a supplemental account, which is Act 19. And then you have Act 100 that created two accounts for different parts of the literacy program made by Act 20, not 19, 20, but no funds were appropriated for that either, right?
Correct.
And so the governor partially vetoed that, even though no funds were appropriated. He used partial veto power to veto part of 100 to create one general literacy program, right?
Correct.
Okay. Is that the program you're trying to fund through Act 19 supplemental account funding?
I think, you know, in the legislature's description of literacy program corresponds only with Act 20. That's the only literacy program that DPI has. So yes, and the appropriation where it can go, and I definitely want to turn to the partial veto quickly soon because I know we don't have much time, but that's what we're asking is for the money to be released into that new appropriation in Act 100-20-255-1FC.
Are you arguing he can partially veto this particular act and create one literacy program? What's the authority for a partial veto of a non-appropriated act?
Right. And I'll move on to that. As we said in our brief, a veto appropriation has two pieces. It has an in and an out. It has money set aside, and it has money, the authorization for the executive branch to spend it. That's consistent with Kletzka and Risser, which we discussed in detail in our brief. And the two appropriations in the Senate bill created two appropriations that went into DPI's appropriation 2255 that authorized it to spend for specific purposes. Now, it referred to the schedule, but most appropriation statutes, and 20003 tells us those are appropriation statutes, kick you out to some other source to find out what monies, if any, are set aside. And if you look at the schedule in 20005, the amount often is zero, but they're not at all off always in the same bill.
Let me just go
back to the veto part a little bit. He could veto it, but can he partially veto?
Yes, because it was an appropriation bill.
How can it be an appropriation bill when there are no funds appropriated?
Because this money set aside is only one component of an appropriation bill. The other part, and that's why Risser uses the disjunctive and why you have provisions in Kletzka and Risser that don't set aside funds being treated as appropriations. He can veto pieces, bills that just set authorize spending, but in themselves don't set aside the money.
It seems like you're conflating 19, 20, and 100 in order to find a pot of money to get these funds from.
Not at all, Your Honor. The SB 971 created two new spending authorizations, two new appropriations. Ledge Council called it an appropriation. That's an appropriation subject to veto.
Can I just springboard off of, are you done, Chief? Because yeah, I want to follow up from what you just asked. So the Circuit Court considered, I think, just what the Chief Justice said, which was that Act 19, Act 20, and Act 20, excuse me, Act 19, Act 20, and Act 100 together, the Circuit Court considered all those together in order to find that Act 100 was an appropriation bill. That's not your argument.
No, it's not.
Okay.
As we said in the brief, we believe there are two essential components of appropriation, the setting aside and the authorization to spend. often located at different parts in the statutes. If you look at each agency's appropriation part of Chapter 20, those are only spending authorities. Those don't tell you what's set aside.
I understand that. I'm having trouble with how you reconcile that with looking at the four corners of Act 100. Are you telling me we don't look at the four corners? Or
nope, you can look just at the four corners because there are two new spending authorities, two new appropriations that are going to go right into 2255 and authorize DPI to spend on specific purposes.
I'm confused.
Yeah.
Will you explain that, please?
So if you look at the language in the definitions of appropriations, so in RISR, right, they say that an appropriation either sets aside money or authorizes the executive branch to spend. And the reason that matters is because state agency spending is not like our personal bank account. An agency can only spend for the specific purposes it's authorized to spend. So it goes through its section of Chapter 20 and says, what am I authorized to spend on here? And then it has to go elsewhere, sometimes to 20005, to find out whether anything was set aside at all for that. But it can only spend on those purposes. It's not like a personal checking account at all. And those purposes in some subsections are very narrow. Sometimes they're a little broader. But that's how the legislature can constrain what the agency spends its funds on. And both those pieces, the reason the governor vetoes more than just amounts in an appropriation bill, but other language too, is because what matters is not just how much he spends, but why those monies are spent.
So 100 created accounts for money to be appropriated into. It did not actually appropriate any money, but you're arguing to us that that is an appropriation bill because it created those accounts, even though money may never be transferred into those accounts, but that's enough to create accounts to be an appropriation bill?
Because the accounts authorize spending for specific purposes. They're not just like a bank account. They actually authorize spending for specific purposes. Act 20 didn't authorize DPI to spend any extra money. All it had was the spending authority already.
Okay, but so you don't have to transfer any money into the account. The creation of accounts for a certain purpose equals an appropriation.
Correct.
What you're asking.
Because otherwise, what the legislature is going to be able to do is strip the governor of his partial veto authority by just divvying up these components.
Well, didn't we kind of tell the legislature to do that when we have the four corners? Isn't this exactly what we've, I mean, it's not exactly because there's no money here. And isn't it what we've told them is like, if you want to to some extent avoid the partial veto, if you want to make sure that that money is not, you can have different bills that address different pieces. I don't know. Do you not see that?
A red light's on. May I answer?
You may.
Great. So this is not a case like Finnegan. Finnegan is a case where there was an fiscal impact of a bill, but there was neither component of an appropriation in Finnegan. It was just, there was an effect that more money would be spent because, you know, of things that were happening outside of the bill. And what this court said is that's not an appropriation just from these indirect effects. This is a different situation. This is saying, RISR says there's two components of an appropriation. And just like the legislature says, well, only money counts. We're saying either part counts. It's the set aside or the spending authorization. But you need both. Just as one example, the legislature set aside $150 million for PFAS in a state trust fund, 2590. The reason it's still sitting there today is no agency has spending authority over it. DNR can't touch it. So that's why you need both those pieces to have an appropriation and why the presence of either piece creates an appropriation bill subject to partial veto.
Can I ask a follow-up on that, Chief? I hear you saying two things. I hear you saying you need both, but you could have or.
Right. You need one for a complete appropriation, but we think that either piece constitutes an appropriation. Either piece to have a functioning appropriation, but we think either piece is an appropriation bill. And that's consistent with the legislature's own argument. They say part A is enough. And we say either part is enough. Nobody is arguing that you need A and B together. And that would really be a disaster because even the budget bill largely works with existing spending authorizations and then kind of decides what it's going to fill in a particular biennium. Lots of times it says, well, not this time, zero. Other times it puts something in. Almost all those spending authorizations are pre-existing. What's kind of different, and it's not unique, but it's less common with this situation is we had a new program that needed to be funded. So we created new spending authorities and we needed to set aside funds, which of course the legislature chose to do with this, what we think is an illegal JCF mechanism.
Okay, that clarifies your argument. Thanks, Chief.
Thank you. You have more time in rebuttal. I'm sure 5 minutes will be plenty.
Feel like plenty.
May it please the court. I'll start with the partial veto question since we've been discussing that. Finnegan announces a very clear, bright line rule that, as Justice Abrahamson explained in Risser, has many benefits. For one, the legislative and executive branches know going into a budget negotiation what the rules are. Bills that spend money are subject to partial veto, bills that don't spend money are not. The virtue of the clear rule is that the branches should be able to figure this out without the court's intervention, the popularly elected branches. And the problem created by the partial veto is that for the first time in our understanding, the governor, when presented with a bill that put zero money in accounts, partially vetoed provisions of that bill. And the problem that created is now JCF, with the money sitting in the supplemental funding account, is at a crossroads. What does it do?
So I've got a question for you. So we've got our Act 19, 20, and 100. And I'm just wondering if you know, is it common to split up programs like this into three separate bills?
I don't know about common. It happens a lot. I don't know if it's
what's the definition of common or a lot.
It happens. I mean, a lot happens. So this, a lot happens in budgeting, right? So stepping back, a little perspective about the separation of powers fight. DPI has had a version of this statutory authority for 76 years. It has employed this authority without controversy for at least 36 years. Started in 1989, both parties have done it. The governor knows full well going into each budget what the rules are. In fact, in his veto message on Act 19, he said, this money is going into a supplemental funding appropriation account administered by JCF. Of course, he fully expected, as did the members of the committee, that this money would eventually be spent on literacy. But then the partial veto of Act 100 came, and now the legislature was put in a bind. How do we fund accounts that have now been improperly altered by the governor's veto pen, which is why we have the case we have today? A particularly problematic part of my friends on the other side's argument is that appropriation appears a few times in the Constitution. One time it appears is in Article 8, Section 8, which says that the legislature has to do a roll call vote when it passes a bill that, quote, makes an appropriation. So we said, if we're wrong, if the governor could partially veto this, then it means the law was improperly enacted because it was passed by a voice vote. Now, we didn't think it was improperly enacted. We were following the bill drafting manual and the settled practice of how to write a budget bill. And the governor didn't say anything at the time about this being improperly enacted. He thought it was properly presented to him. Now, my friends respond, well, appropriation means different things in the two different constitutional provisions. And here's a quote. What makes it, this is from 23 of their response brief, what makes it an appropriation bill under Article 5, Section 10 does not mean it makes an appropriation of money. So their counterclaim is that this bill makes no appropriation. The claim is that it does make an appropriation. I don't know how to make sense of that. And this court in Risser actually said, you're supposed to read the two constitutional provisions together. It discusses at length a case called McDonald, which is all about Article 8, Section 8. And it says, we have to read appropriation to mean the same thing. You can't have an appropriation bill that makes no appropriation. It just doesn't make sense. Another reason to apply the settled rule is that the legislature routinely follows set drafting procedures when crafting a budget. And one of them, on page 24 of the bill drafting manual, which this court has cited as the authority for what constitutes an appropriation, it says, the purpose of including the phrase making an appropriation in a bill is to inform the legislature that the bill is subject to the requirements of Article 8, Section 8 of the Constitution. Act 100, Senate Bill 971, did not include that language. Now, I think the constitutional argument at the end of the day is that, made by the other side, is that Act 19, the budget itself was unconstitutional because it gave money to JCF, clearly putting it in JCF's supplemental funding account, but should not have done so because the money, in their view, was intended or earmarked for JCF. But if that's the case, they're challenging the wrong bill. And to Justice Hagedorn's point, what's the remedy? The remedy is that this money just goes back to the Treasury. It doesn't go to DPI. So
that's the remedy. That's what you think the remedy is on the veto issue. Yes?
Yeah, I think if you accept their constitutional argument,
wait, Justice, it goes back to the Treasury or it stays in JCF?
I think under their constitutional argument, because yeah, it is not okay to give money to JCF when it's earmarked for a particular agency, I think the remedy, if you were to accept that argument, would be to say Act 19, which the governor signed and was passed by bipartisan majority, is unconstitutional in part, and therefore the $250 million, of which the $50 million is a part, goes back to the Treasury.
But you don't agree with that. That's just the natural outcome if they're correct on their argument, but you don't think they're correct on their argument.
Right. The money was...
I just want to clarify so that you're saying that their argument that because they're relying on 13101 sub 7, right? Is that, and you disagree with,
right?
Disagree.
Okay. Right.
So I understand your view of their argument.
Yeah.
Tell me about under your argument regarding the governor's veto, your remedy, what happens with the money?
We actually agree about this. So if you agree with us that Act 100 or Senate Bill 971 as presented to the governor was not an appropriation bill, then it means that Senate Bill 971 goes into law. The only exception to that remedy is if the legislature adjourns within the 6-day period where the governor has the bill on his desk, in which case it would not go into law.
I understand that. But then under that scenario, the money stays with JCF. It doesn't go back to the Treasury.
It goes back to the Treasury at the end of the biennium. So this is a biennial appropriation. The end of the biennium is coming up pretty soon here.
Okay, actually. But say the end of the biennium was today, it would stay in the joint finance, or the, why do we call it joint finance sometime and the Joint Committee on Finance other times?
JCF, JFC.
Kind of very confusing, but forget that. You don't have
to. We have more difficulty.
I know, sorry. I apologize. Apologize. If it were to today, though, I understand the timing of this, and I understand we're getting close to the end of the biennium. I understand that it ends on June 30th. I get all that. But your argument, say we're a year ago, say it's 2024, your argument would mean that the money would stay in the JCF account, wouldn't it?
As a result of this litigation, if we're correct, yes. Okay. Stays in the JCF account. And then we get to deploy that money under Act 100 as actually passed. Act 100 created the accounts that we want to put the money in, right? So the reason the events unfolded the way they did here is the budget was passed before the literacy bill, but the literacy bill was passed a couple weeks later. So let's talk about emergencies.
Wait a minute, but it wouldn't be as Act 100 was passed because it would have been Act 100 passed as Senate Bill 971. Because you're arguing that the governor exercised his veto power illegally. Mm-hmm. So it wouldn't be Act 100 that we're talking about here. It would have been the language that had been in SB 971, that would have been the law that would have been in effect.
Yes, that should be the result of litigation.
And you said you get to deploy the money as Act 100 actually passed, but you don't have to, right? There's nothing in the law that says that JCF has to ever deploy this money to DPI.
JCF is subject to 13101 sub 3, so it would have to follow 13101 sub 3, and it's bound by 13101 sub 3 because Act 19 put the money in the supplemental funding account. The supplemental funding account statute, which is 2865, mirrors the language of the supplemental funding account statute. So there really ought not be a question that this money goes into that account and then can be dispersed under 13101.
Right, but I'm looking at 13101. You don't have to give it to anyone in particular. Even though it's earmarked, there's nothing that requires that it go to DPI.
That is formally correct.
Okay, well, Claire, please clarify. What do you mean by formally?
There is no statutory obligation for JCF to disperse this money. But if discretion, we all know what an abuse of discretion is, right? So JCF is given discretion and it's given a standard. So it needs to follow the standard. When presented with a request under 13101, it has to apply 13101.
What happens if it doesn't?
Then?
Well, there aren't, right? Who says, then what?
But as a practical matter, this is the law that they passed for two programs. The governor made it one program. They thought that changed their ability to fund it and his ability to use partial veto for a non-appropriated act was wrong. So it put you in the position of not being able to fund it until it is deemed to be what was passed.
Right.
And so why wouldn't it fund what it passed and said it wanted to fund? It's just holding the funds in JCF until the two acts are deemed to be valid and it gets funded.
And that is how it has worked over the decades. The money goes to where it is.
But what if it doesn't? I mean, there, I understand. I don't disagree with what the Chief Justice said. I'm not disagreeing with what you're saying, but I'm asking, like, what if they abuse that discretion? There aren't really any guardrails here, I guess.
Is that the case we have before?
It's not the case. I can speculate a little bit with you, Justice. I don't want to resist the question. I suppose there could be circumstances where the abuse of discretion is so clear and maybe there's like some supervisory writ that could be brought. I don't know. It just doesn't happen.
I mean, what would stop the legislature from emptying every last dollar of the Wisconsin Treasury into a JCF emergency account?
Legislature would prefer to have control over what the Constitution gives it authority over. And I'm glad you asked that question.
This accounts a very small part of the state budget, correct?
Yes. So in the last 10 years, the percentage of the budget that has gone to JCF supplemental account has ranged from 0.06% in 2017 to 2019 to 0.33% in 2021-2023.
But that's just a statistic. I mean, to Justice Krofsky's question, nothing would prevent, the way you're reading this, nothing would prevent all of the money, every last dollar, to be put into JCF.
I think a lot of things would prevent it, which is why it's never happened. The governor would never sign it.
One more follow-up, Justice Bradley, if you don't mind. Is it your reading, though, that money then has to be distributed only according to an emergency?
No, I'm glad you asked. So emergency in a sense, yes. So the statute says unforeseen emergency or insufficient to meet the purposes.
So right. You could not fund something at all and then find it insufficient to meet the purposes? Is that really what was going on here?
Well, it depends. So an emergency can either be unforeseen or not unforeseen. It has to mean that under 13101 unless you strike words from the statute.
And they don't have to find it's an emergency under the second part of that, which is what
they do, but it can be a not unforeseen emergency.
What is an unforeseen emergency?
I'll tell you, up north, we get a lot of blizzards. Right? So if a blizzard hits northern Wisconsin in January, is it unforeseen? Well, in a sense, that particular blizzard couldn't have been predicted maybe 3 weeks before, but it's still an urgent issue that requires immediate action.
So can't you foresee when you create when you have a bill that only has accounts but puts no money in it, isn't it foreseeable that you're not going to be able to run any programs from that? And how is that going to be an unforeseen emergency? How could this ever work the way this is set up?
Well, it works this way all the time until the governor improperly partially vetoes.
Okay, even if let's take that out. The governor didn't, let's say. You're telling me that that money has to be either a foreseen emergency or an unforeseen emergency, but the legislature created a bill that created accounts that put no money in it. So that doesn't seem to be either a foreseen emergency or an unforeseen emergency. I mean, it seems to me like they just didn't fund it. How's that an emergency?
I think the typical practice is to put money in JCF supplemental funding account to deal with things that are expected to come up that require urgent action. So okay. In this case, the budget bill was passed a couple weeks before Act 20. It wasn't a surprise to everyone that Act 20 would be passed. It was in the works. So then we had to create accounts. We always have to create accounts to put the money in. The money has to be parked somewhere. So that's Senate Bill 971. But then at that point, the governor decided he wanted to change the policies. And that's why we're here today.
And so I wanted to ask about what we need to decide in this case. Suppose that we agree with your argument that there is no remedy in terms of giving that $50 million. I'm not talking about the partial veto. I'm talking about the funds and the, I mean, there is a declaration claim, but if we agree that with your argument that there is no remedy for that $50 million, what else do we need to decide, if anything?
Yeah, so for the counterclaim, which is the $50 million, it is a non-redressable injury given a lot of reasons, including the parties. So the court need not even adjudicate that claim on the merits. As to the partial veto claim, that claim is alive even past this biennium, because the partial veto purported to create a continuing appropriation. So we're still going to have this problem.
So putting aside, and I realize we need to address partial veto issue, but just to make sure you understand. So just on if we address the partial veto question, whether that was an appropriations bill or not, in your view, if we agree with you, there is no remedy, we don't really need to go any further in even addressing the underlying constitutional questions.
That is correct. And if there are no further questions, I'll take my seat.
Oh. Well, you know, I paused because
might be your last question.
Oh my God!
I'm intimidated.
I don't think so.
No pressure.
It better be good.
It better be good, but that's right. Maybe I'll just demur. You know, I
don't think you can ask her more questions. That's okay.
It seems to me that was the juice, in part, of why we are here. That some want us to take a look at this structure allowing JFC to have this discretion, and that not to address it would be a rather lame opinion. Your
Well, I would never accuse this court of issuing lame opinions. They're always But I'm not the typical audience, I suppose. I think even under DPI's position, you don't need to reach the constitutional question. So I don't think anybody is insisting that you decide whether JCF's supplemental funding structure, which has been in place a long time. And by the way, the governor and the legislature are assuming it's still in place. We have a new budget pending. It puts money in JCF's supplemental funding account. DPI is asking us for money out of the supplemental funding account. So there are lots of reasons to be cautious here. You could really revolutionize how budgeting is done in Wisconsin by reaching out and unnecessarily deciding that. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Rebuttal.
Need we address the constitutional issue that your opposing counsel just eschewed?
Absolutely, Your Honor. It's critical to us that this court issue a declaration that this structure is not continue in the next budget. This is not a crisis. It's easy enough to put money that the legislature wants for particular programs into appropriate spending authorities appropriations in each agency's budget. You've seen at page 17 of our brief, this has skyrocketed in the last two budgets. They don't need to do it this way, and it needs to stop.
Did the governor's budget that he just proposed include putting money into this?
So what I believe, and I don't know what the new one did, the last one said, let's put like 133,000, I'm guessing, in for just emergencies and not the true emergencies. So the blizzard in Wausau.
Sure, but your argument is that's unconstitutional. So did the governor just propose an unconstitutional budget provision?
We're not trying to take on the emergency appropriation.
But your argument certainly would extend to that, right?
Correct. Correct.
So you are actually.
But what I really am trying to address is the idea that the world's going to fall apart if we can't pack hundreds of millions of dollars.
The world's not going to fall apart. But the logic of the argument you're making is important.
You're right, Honor.
The extent of your argument is that whole structure of sending money to JFC is always unconstitutional, which would affect a significant change. And I understand that your position, but it's a big deal.
Yeah, so I disagree that it's a big deal, the difference between what happened in the past and what's happened in the last two budget. I know percentage-wise it may seem small, but it's huge to these agencies. $50 million was so critical to DPI because this literacy program, which we're all so excited about, is really expensive. Assessments and curriculum and trainers and leadership. That money would have made a big difference in the last 2 years for our school districts around the state. But I want to turn to the partial veto too, because I don't have much time. There is nothing unique about our argument here on the in and the out part of appropriations. If you look at our brief on Kletzka and Risser, both places, the court described provisions that themselves set aside no funds and only created spending authority as appropriations. Both in Kletzka, that was section 47 of the bill there, and in Risser, it was at note 7 where it talks about DOT spending authorities. No money set aside within those spending authorities themselves as appropriations.
No money set aside, but a funding mechanism in Kletzka, the in and out, right?
Right, but if you look at the court's discussion of section 47, it's not relying on section 52 where the set aside was. Mm-hmm. It's just looking at that piece to see whether it's an appropriation and says it's set aside money for a public purpose without relying on section 52. And then just getting to the yays and nays quickly, Kletzka tells us they're not coextensive. My friend is misreading McDonald and ignoring Kletzka. And what Article 8, Section 8 does is it has a list of things that add money to the Treasury or take away money from the Treasury. So taxes, undertaking credit, forgoing the repayment of debt. And so the first part, the in part of an appropriation where we set aside money, that's pulling money out of the Treasury. But when we give an agency spending authority, it doesn't necessarily do that. And that's why you have that different result between Article 5, Section 10 and Article 8, Section 8. And in conclusion, what we're asking for fundamentally is to stop this illegal practice that JCF is doing and to confirm that the governor's vetoes of Senate Bill 971 were proper. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much. Very interesting oral argument. And again, my congratulations. The court is adjourned in this matter, but we will meet in closed conference promptly after oral argument this morning.